I've seen nothing in the plan that would indicate that there is something that would be beneficial to anyone other than Russia if the Chinese plan were followed. And so the idea that China is going to be negotiating the outcome of a war that's a totally unjust war for Ukraine is just not rational.
President Biden speaking to ABC News about China's proposal to settle the war in Ukraine. China released its plan on the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion. Now, as we enter the second year of the war, American officials are increasingly concerned that China will supply Russia with weapons as Russia struggles to win the war it started. This comes as a major Kremlin ally, the president of Belarus, heads to Beijing for a state dinner this week. Until now, China has remained cautious about getting too involved. It supports Russia diplomatically. It's bought oil and gas from Russia, but it has refused so far to supply direct military aid. A decision to change that, well, that could change everything. Joining me now to talk about this is Oriana Schuyler-Mastro. She's a fellow at Stanford and the American Enterprise Institute, where she studies Chinese military and security policy. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So China releases this statement on the Ukraine crisis, and it's greeted with, as we say, we just heard from President Biden and also from the EU, with a non-enthusiastic response, to say the least. What was in the statement that caused them to be, so disapproving of it?
Well, I have to say there's nothing in this statement that is surprising. I could have a week ago written a predictable statement coming out of China on the Ukraine crisis, and it would hit all the highlights of what China usually says when there's international crises of this sort. Things like respecting sovereignty, abandoning Cold War mentalities. So these are direct accusations and criticisms of the United States for playing politics, and in particular, funding Ukraine or taking sides in conflicts. China tends not to provide military aid to parties that are in the middle of a war. They never have. That's why this discussion of whether or not they will is so important. But the statement itself sort of criticized the United States and, of course, called for a resolution of peace talks. And China did say that they'd be willing to provide a mediation role in that. But in their view, to get there, the U.S. sanctions and the sanctions posed by the United States and its allies and partners have to stop. So this is very similar to what they say with respect to crises on the Korean Peninsula, for example, they have a different viewpoint about how to get to a resolution.
They also have a different viewpoint about whether they're preparing to arm Russia, because American officials say that they are, and they have rejected that, saying that's not just simply not the case. What do you think is happening when it comes to that?
Well, I don't think China is arming Russia. I want to be very careful here for the listeners, because the Chinese government says a lot of things, like with the recent balloon incident. They say it's a weather balloon when it's definitely not a weather balloon. It is difficult to parse out what are truthful statements and what aren't. In this case, based on the information I have and what I know about Chinese military strategy, how they approach arms sales, how they approach foreign conflicts, how they approach their relationship with Russia, there really is no room for direct support of the Russian military here. At the most, what I can say is maybe the United States is referring to one state-owned enterprise that was potentially going to provide some dual-use type of technologies like drones. China does provide drones to countries. And so the U.S. government felt like it was necessary to tell China that they didn't even want that level of support provided at this stage. But I don't think there is any situation in which China is arming Russia.
So why would the U.S. say that right now?
Well, so I don't know. I think when you looked at the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, and the CIA director, then went on news shows yesterday to say that there was no indication that China was arming Russia, and they did not believe that they were going to do so in the future. So I'm not 100% sure what the strategy is. Maybe they saw some intelligence suggesting that there was consideration in Beijing, so they wanted to get ahead of it. But what we do know is that arms sales have never been a big part of Chinese foreign policy. They're definitely not a part of, you know, how China deals with overseas conflicts. And so, yeah, it is quite confusing to me also why we came out so publicly about it, because this gives China an out. They're not providing Russia with support. And I think the best bet for China and Russia to go their separate ways is for Russia to be disappointed in China. But instead, China can now say it's U.S. pressure that's preventing them from providing the support that they weren't going to provide anyway.
Interesting. Also this week, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko is meeting in China with Xi. And so what are we to make of this visit?
I think whether it's this president or past leaders in the past few weeks from Germany and France making their way to China, the big takeaway for me is that China hasn't had to really pay any political, economic, military costs associated with their closer relationship with Russia. The European countries and countries in the region, those relationships are really critical to Beijing. But thus far, they've been able to have their cake and eat it too by providing Russia at least with rhetorical support and in critical economic support in the form of continuing trade and purchasing of things like oil and agricultural products, but not having to have that harm their relationship with key players in the region.
Right. And so Biden also, in that interview on Friday with ABC's David Muir, talked about possible sanctions if China were to supply weapons or any kind of military aid, then the United States would respond. He was vague about how the United States would respond, but conceivably, what could the United States and what would the United States do? Because, you know, trade sanctions on China can cut both ways with the U.S.
Right. I mean, I would find it surprising if the United States did anything that wasn't sort of symbolic in nature. Our allies and partners are reluctant to sanction, to consider serious sanctions on China if they invade and occupy Taiwan. Now you're telling me we're going to consider sanctions if they sell, you know, some drones or possible ammunition to the Russians. I worry that the United States has put itself out there and when push comes to shove is not going to be able to put together something significant. And so that's why I would have thought if there is any evidence of a change in Chinese policy that the United States was concerned about, it probably would have been better to approach the Chinese privately to deal with it.
Yeah, right. And Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who's in Ukraine today, also dodged that question. She was asked specifically, would the U.S. levy sanctions on China, and didn't answer that.
Right. This is a very important, like, boy who cries wolf type of situation. If we're trying to convince China not to take Taiwan by force, it's important that when we threaten things like economic sanctions, we really, you know, would follow through with them. But more importantly, there's a lot of areas in this competition with China where it's not that China's outcompeting us, it's we're competing in different areas. So we're like doing something completely differently. And then we're like, look, we're winning the competition. And China's just really not interested. And foreign military intervention is one of those things. And arms sales is one of those things. You know, the United States sells more arms in 1 year to partners and allies than, you know, China has in like a decade. So they're just not trying to compete with us in those areas. And so I think it's important before we start doubling down on certain aspects of our foreign policy and military strategy to realize that we're kind of doing that alone and maybe look to how China builds power in different ways to counter them in a unique way.
Well, you mentioned Taiwan. How does this factor in to this whole idea of China getting close to Russia over the war in Ukraine? Is China going to expect some return of favor should it decide to make a move with Taiwan?
So this is a very important point. I'm finishing up this like 3-year research project on the China-Russia military relationship. Their relationship, they're very close, but the alignment is for a very specific purpose. And that's to challenge the U.S. role in Asia. Everything points to this, from their types of military exercises to where they exercise to Russian supply of the Chinese military. It's really kind of one-sided. The Russians would benefit if China manages to unseat the U.S. in Asia, but the relationship has never been for China to support Russia and Europe. So the fact that we haven't seen a great deal of direct Chinese support does not mean that we won't see the same from Russia. Indeed, what I see between those two militaries is the preparation for Russia to serve as a kind of strategic and strategic rear to China to supply equipment, weapons, war material, oil, close up airspace and things like that with their joint patrols in the East China Sea that would severely complicate the United States and its allies and partners' efforts to defend Taiwan. And so I don't think China takes lessons directly from Ukraine, but I also don't think we should and say, well, you know, China hasn't provided a lot of support to Russia, so Russia probably will also fall short in its support of China in the case of a conflict. I don't think those two things are equivalent.
Well, thanks very much. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Oriana Schuyler Mastro, fellow at Stanford and the American Enterprise Institute, where she studies Chinese military and security policy. Coming up, why Fox News is in trouble and the future of President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. It rests with the Supreme Court. Our legal, Jessica Levinson, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in a pair of challenges to President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. Nearly $500 billion worth of debt relief is at stake, and whatever the court decides could affect really tens of millions of people. It's a big test of executive power that pits a conservative and skeptical Supreme Court against an administration that had been ambitious with how it has responded to the economic instability caused by the COVID pandemic. It is Monday, so our legal is here, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so they're hearing two cases tomorrow, which cover similar ground. One case brought by six Republican-led states, the other brought by two student loan borrowers and a conservative group that is representing them. What are the arguments?
So they're, as you said, very similar. They're both basically arguing two things. One, we have standing to sue, meaning in both cases, we're injured enough, we're the right people to bring these claims. And the other thing they're arguing is that the Secretary of Education just didn't have the power under a federal law known as the HEROES Act to provide this type of student loan relief. Now, a lot of details, obviously, in both of those different arguments, but they both come down to one, yes, we can be here. Yes, we can sue. And then two, Secretary of Education, you overstepped. You did not have the statutory authority to implement this program.
So is it possible that the court would just rule on the standing issue and say, and not really rule on the merits of the case? And then if that happens, then what?
Then nobody, in fact, can challenge this particular program. I think it's entirely possible. I think there are very real standing issues in this case. I know for a lot of people, maybe it doesn't sound that sexy to talk about standing. You and I have talked about it in a lot of big cases. And basically, as you said, there's two cases, one dealing with Republican-led states, another dealing with individual borrowers. And in both cases, the Biden administration has said, we really don't think you're harmed enough by the federal government saying we're canceling your loan debt. Just to take, for instance, the individuals who are suing, their argument is, well, we just missed the ability to be part of this program. And so we're actually harmed because we didn't get to go in and submit notes and comments so that you could have created a program that would have covered us. The Biden administration says that's too speculative. What you really are suing for is to say that the entire program shouldn't exist. And that's not enough of this kind of direct, concrete harm that we're talking about when we talk about standing.
It's so interesting. So they're saying, well, because we are not getting a piece of this, the whole thing should go. No one should get anything.
Exactly. Exactly. And so in one case, it's somebody who just earns too much, I believe. And then in another case, it's somebody who can't get the full amount because they didn't get a Pell Grant. People who got Pell Grants can actually get more student loan relief. But in both cases, they just kind of missed the ability to fully avail themselves of the program. Now, of course, when it comes to the states, they have even different arguments for why they have standing. Some of the states are claiming we'll actually get less tax revenue because of how they calculate federal adjusted income and how that federal adjusted income relates to when you pay off your student loans. Biden administration basically says the same thing. One, which is like, that's just conjecture. That's too speculative. And that's an injury of your own causing. But I think we're going to hear a lot tomorrow about standing, maybe even more than we hear about the HEROES Act.
So meanwhile, all the people who applied, and it is millions of people who have applied and millions of applications that have been approved, I think 16 million, those are in limbo and no one can apply now for relief. But what happens after this case is decided?
Well, obviously, of course, it depends on how it's decided. So the court should, I think, decide by June 30th. The federal government has said, basically, we might want to try and restart the program by June 30th either way. But if there's a ruling where the court says nobody has standing to sue, then the program would go into effect unless there's another suit brought by different plaintiffs and another lower court judge that tries to put the entire program on hold. But the punchline for people right now is you cannot apply. If the court says nobody has standing, my guess is that the program will go into effect. Of course, if the court says actually these people do have standing and the Secretary of Education overstepped their authority, then the program would not go into effect.
Okay, I want to switch gears and turn to a recent court filing in a big defamation lawsuit filed by Dominion Voting Systems against Fox News. So the network pushed a lot of false claims about a stolen election after the election, and their biggest target was Dominion, who makes election hardware and software. And here's just a bit of what Fox was saying back then in November 2020.
We don't know how many votes were stolen. We don't know anything about the software that many say was rigged.
Attorney Sidney Powell is leading the charge against Dominion, and she says she has enough evidence of fraud to launch a massive criminal investigation.
That is where the fraud took place, where they were flipping votes in the computer system or adding votes that did not exist.
No one knows their ownership. It is the most ludicrous, irresponsible, and rancid system.
Okay, Lou Dobbs, attorney Sidney Powell, Maria Bartiromo, Tucker Carlson, all in that waterfall of clips. Meanwhile, the text messages, their private text messages, were released recently, and they're saying opposite things, right? And this is at the heart of what Dominion is claiming, that there was a malicious intent to defame it.
Exactly. One of the things you need in a case like this, when we're talking about public figures, is you need to show that the defendants had actual malice. Typically, that's really difficult. So for a defamation case that Dominion's bringing, you have to show publication of a statement of fact, and you have to show that the statement was made with actual malice and that it would harm the plaintiff's reputation. Actual malice is a really difficult standard because you have to show that the defendant, in this case, Fox, that they knew what they were saying was false, or that they recklessly disregarded the falsity. Typically, you need a smoking gun. I would say the text messages in this case, it's getting pretty close to a smoking gun. I mean, you have various Fox hosts saying things like, Sidney Powell is lying, by the way. I caught her. It's insane. That's Tucker Carlson to Laura Ingraham. Laura responding, Sidney is a complete nut. No one will work with her. Ditto with Rudy. And so in these text messages, what we see isn't just that Fox News hosts are putting people on their program and purporting to discuss this as, you know, potentially there is fraud, but that they know really that there's nothing there. And that's we're getting very, very close to what you need for actual malice. And what Fox will claim is, well, we're just reporting on a story, but they're actually amplifying this false narrative. They're not just saying people say. In other portions here, I think they are either saying or getting very close to saying, and there's some merit to these claims.
So Dominion is seeking $1.5 billion in damages. And do you think this will go to trial, or will there be a summary judgment?
So In this case, there is potentially a summary judgment. It would mean that there are no genuine disputes of facts that a judge can make this determination. I don't think that's what Fox wants. At this point, I think not at the point of predictions at this point.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. We will undoubtedly talk to you about this further down the road. Jessica Levinson, our regular legal eagle here on Press Play. She teaches at Loyola Law School. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, California is considering banning the use of police dogs to arrest people.
Every time they would look at, you know, a reflection of themselves, they would see a dog bite on their shoulder or on their thigh. And it was just a constant reminder of that terror and that trauma.
Authorities have used dogs to subjugate people for centuries. The story of dogs and policing from Columbus to the present day. That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A few weeks ago, two California lawmakers introduced a bill that would ban the use of police dogs to arrest or apprehend suspects, or as a form of crowd control. The California Department of Justice says back in 2021, police dogs caused more serious injuries or deaths than either tasers or batons, and that nearly two-thirds of use of force incidents involving dogs were against people who are Black or Latino.
Canine units are used not just in a disproportionate manner against poor Black and brown community members, but just their existence serves to terrorize and to create a menacing environment in communities that are struggling to survive.
San Jose Democratic Assemblyman Ash Kalra is one of the bill's authors. That terror he's talking about is captured in one of the iconic images of the civil rights movement in 1963 Birmingham, Alabama.
The scene is last Saturday. The place is near the 16th Street Baptist Church, the starting point for Negro demonstrations.
That day, Police Chief Bull Connor turned fire hoses and police dogs on nonviolent protesters.
For a month, the two communities, Negro and white in Birmingham, had been building up to scenes, to clashes like this. The situation was perilously close to an explosion.
My next guest says that moment is just one chapter in a centuries-long practice of police using dogs to terrorize people. The Jim Crow era, the antebellum slave patrols, even the Spanish conquistadors used trained dogs to overpower indigenous people as they colonized the New World. Tyler Perry is a historian and professor of African American and African diaspora studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, let's talk about the proposed legislation in California in a little bit. But first, can we go way, way back and talk about that history I just mentioned in the 15th century with the conquistadors? How did they use dogs against the people who were living here?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really deep multi-century, multi-continental history. What occurs during the colonization process, first with the Spanish, and then shortly afterwards with British and Portuguese colonists as well, is the attacks become deliberately racialized. And then once the expansion of chattel slavery occurs to where more and more people of African descent are populating the continent as enslaved people, the dog becomes a tool of surveillance and containment to ensure that enslaved people are not able to run away from the plantation. So the phases and the sagas that are occurring here is that dogs are first used to clear indigenous people from the land and then used to contain people of African descent upon the agricultural plantations.
And are the dogs bred specifically to attack humans and specifically to attack people of color, to recognize skin tone, skin differences?
Yeah, essentially what we find is that the dogs were specifically bred for brutality. They were effectively, since puppyhood, staked to the ground, food was withheld from them, and the breeders of the dog, the Portuguese or the Spanish breeders of the dog in particular, forced a black man to do this to the dog. Mm. So in their minds, the dog was actually being conditioned to see a person of African descent, particularly a man of African descent, as an enemy. And so once they basically find the dog suitable, and this usually meant that the dog could track and attack the person once they ran away, that dog could actually be sold on market for the specific purpose of catching enslaved people who were trying to escape to freedom.
Wow. I mean, when I associate dogs hunting down fugitive slaves, I think of bloodhounds.
Yeah. So oftentimes enslaved people weren't running away from just one dog. They were probably trying to escape from 3, 4, even up to 10, because many slave hunters preferred to use the dogs in packs. And the dogs could be different from each other. Sometimes there was a dog that was included in the pack that was particularly physically powerful. There was one dog that may have been faster than the others. And then there was a dog that had a better sense of smell than the others. And one of the things that becomes very clear, though, is that if you read the narratives of formerly enslaved people, they would say that these weren't just ordinary bloodhounds. There was something different about these particular bloodhounds, suggesting that these dogs were probably interbred with other dog breeds in order to make them more ferocious and more violent when trying to subdue an enslaved person. So they did use bloodhounds, but the type of bloodhound they used was likely a version that was meant to tackle and subdue and bite in a way that a conventional, like, English bloodhound with long ears might not have done as much.
Right. But I think now we associate the use of these dogs with the German Shepherd, the civil rights protests that we mentioned in the intro with Bull Connor in Alabama, that was a German Shepherd attacking a protester. And then you think of German Shepherds and, of course, Nazi Germany.
Yes, specifically, I mean, Hitler did love German Shepherds, and he believed they were a symbol of Nazi Germany and the Aryan race. And also, German Shepherds were known to be very powerful dogs. They're very intimidating animals. And if your entire political career is based upon the establishment of a international superpower and the subjugation of marginalized people, then you want a dog that would be in service to that particular goal. German Shepherds also seem to take commands very well. These are dogs that were bred for both military service and police work. And so it seems that when people kind of appropriated the German Shepherd for their own, it was with the intent that this is a dog that would symbolize authority, it would symbolize order, and it would symbolize conformity to the demands of the state. And so when the dogs are used for police work, particularly by the 1950s as canine units are established, the reputation of the German Shepherd preceded it.
So are you saying that American police departments following World War II in the 50s and the 60s purposefully adopted the German Shepherd because of its association with Nazi Germany?
I don't think I could make the case that they deliberately did it through the association with Nazi Germany, though there were certainly connections between the way that Nazi Germany was inspired by Jim Crow policies. But one thing you do find is that there was some evidence. I think the NAACP did an investigation. Dog trainers who once lived in Nazi Germany and had trained and bred these dogs actually were found in parts of the South training the dogs for the purposes of police work in the Jim Crow South. And when you even consider the types of commands that even dogs today take in police work, many of them respond to German commands. And some of the dog breeding ranches or locations actually do have names that resemble Nazi Germany. And so, particularly during the civil rights movement, that memory is palpable. And the continued use of these dogs in a post-civil rights America is a strong statement that there's an unwillingness within the many American governments to actually address the symbols of terror that continue to haunt marginalized communities in the United States.
When did the LAPD start using dogs? When did that department start a canine unit for this purpose?
Yes, I have to admit, I don't know the specific date, but I know that the program was amplified by the 1980s. And this was in direct response to the kind of self-proclaimed drug war. And that will actually lead to some significant tension amongst the LAPD and specifically Black communities, many of whom, you know, were one generation removed from the Jim Crow South and the Civil Rights era, where they were very familiar with, you know, what it means for a German Shepherd canine unit to prowl through one's neighborhood and what that means. And but you also have complaints from Black communities extending back into the 1960s, to where they are saying that there's an overrepresentation of police dogs within their communities. And that only gets worse by the 1980s and the 90s as the drug war is ramped up to an era that it hadn't seen before.
Yeah, you certainly don't see a lot of canine units being used in places like Beverly Hills.
Right. Yes.
For example.
Yeah, exactly.
However, they can be useful, right, when it comes to search and rescue or bomb sniffing, I don't know, illegal drug smuggling across the border. You certainly see these dogs in international terminals and airports. And when they're used for that, you know, they can be used for good purpose.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I am actually a large supporter of the ways in which dogs and humans can benefit each other. I mean, they are our oldest friend. We've co-evolved for tens of thousands of years at this point. And really, in many ways, dogs know us better than we know ourselves. They're very aware of subconscious feelings that, you know, the owner might be feeling or the handler might be feeling. And that can go one of two ways. Either a dog can be, you know, very affectionate in one's time of need, or it can be very aggressive if it senses that the owner themselves are nervous. And so the essential issue is that regardless of what a handler might claim, the dog can get out of control at any point. Because if a canine unit is brought, say, to a protest, what is the intended goal of bringing the dog for crowd control? Because effectively, what you've told the crowd is that I am willing to sick this dog on you if I perceive that you're getting out of line, or if you run away after I give you a command. And as noted, statistically, it does bear this out, that police dogs are one of the largest percentages of hospitalizations when talking about the use of force.
Let me play one more clip from the other author of this California bill. This is Paris Democratic Assemblyman Corey Jackson.
Many of these bites can create lifelong injuries. We're already giving out life sentences before someone is even proven guilty in the first place.
So that's really interesting in that the police seem to be using these dogs in certain circumstances to inflict a punishment before a suspect has even possibly been arrested.
Yes, it does reflect that it's a guilty before proven innocent type of mentality. And I think that's a really powerful comment about the physical and emotional scars that occur after a vicious dog attack. That, and this extends back into the era of slavery, to where enslaved people, once they gained freedom and wrote down their autobiographies or provided some commentary about their lives, they would actually talk about being bitten by dogs and how every time they would look at, you know, a reflection of themselves, they would see a dog bite on their shoulder or on their thigh. And it was just a constant reminder of that terror and that trauma that they went through.
Yeah. What about the argument that if you're using a dog, it's less likely it will be lethal than if police unholster their weapon?
Yeah, I mean, I find that the argument that, you know, it's better than a gun is a very American thing, that mm-hmm. and that's kind of problematic for us at this point, because yes, of course, a dog is better than the bullet, but why does it have to be a comparison of one or the other? What is the problem essentially with eliminating dog attacks from police work? Because I do think that if we continue to debase people below animals, that we do lose a part of our humanity in the process. And considering that there is a long legacy of these dog attacks being very overtly racialized, I think it's high time that we reconsider.
And so I assume that you're in favor of this bill that's been introduced.
Yeah, I think this bill is reasonable. It doesn't eliminate dogs from police work. It actually allows them to use their senses for the best ways possible. All it asks is to not debase people below animals. And I don't know what the counter argument to this would be.
Well, and I thank you so much for coming on the show today. Fascinating discussion.
Thank you for the opportunity.
My pleasure. That's Tyler Perry, professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Coming up, we'll discuss and listen to the songs nominated for an Oscar this year. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. That's Lady Gaga singing Hold My Hand from the movie Top Gun Maverick, one of the five nominees for Best Song at this year's Academy Awards. She's up against another pop megastar, Rihanna. Also against a couple of indie musicians and a 14-time nominee. Joining us to talk about the Best Song nominees is film critic Noah Gittel. Welcome to Press Play, Noah.
Thanks for having me back, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, let's talk about Lady Gaga, because we just heard her singing. And she already won won an Oscar in 2019 for her song from A Star Is Born, the song Shallow. What are your thoughts on this one, Hold My Hand?
I think it's a very nice song that is really elevated by Lady Gaga's voice. So not to take anything away from the song itself, the performance is definitely part of it, and the performance is great. And I think the Academy really likes Lady Gaga. Not only did she win this category in 2019 for Shallow, she was also nominated for Best Actress that year. And let's not forget that she, along with Liza Minnelli, announced Best Picture last year, which is a spot that's really reserved for Hollywood royalty. So the Academy loves her, and the song is good. It's a serious contender.
Okay, a serious contender. And the movie, I mean, just as a side note, do you think that's a serious contender for Best Picture? It did make, I think, more than $1 billion at the box office. So maybe Hollywood wants to reward that.
Yeah, as some people would say, the money is its own reward, and that the Academy should point their spotlight onto smaller films that really need the attention. But Top Gun Maverick is a little bit of a unique situation, because a lot of folks, including Steven Spielberg, who was recently caught on video saying this to Tom Cruise, feel that that movie sort of saved theatrical distribution. It is possible that the Academy could lavish this kind of praise and awards onto it as a reward for that. I still think it's an underdog. I think there's another film, Everything Everywhere All at Once, that really is in the pole position here. It's the strong front runner, and I don't see anything else taking it down.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about that song that's nominated from that movie in a minute. But first, let's talk about Rihanna, fresh from the Super Bowl halftime show. Let's listen to her song, Lift Me Up, from Black Panther, Wakanda Forever.
Lift me up, hold me down, keep me close, safe and sound, drowning in an endless sea, take some time and stay with me.
Okay, so Noah, this song is slow, a lot slower than the songs from her Super Bowl set. And it's her first nomination. She's supposed to perform it, I think, at the ceremony. How do you feel about this song? How do you think it worked in the movie?
I think it's a beautiful song. And I'm not normally a fan of nominating songs that simply play over the end credits. I really prefer when they're integrated into the film in some way. But I thought it worked perfectly in the movie, which ends with a big climactic battle, obviously, and then this very quiet, emotional denouement. And the film, the song that follows that moment when the credits start to roll really captures the feeling of that moment and of the film, which is very mournful, but also empowering. And the song is not flashy in any way. It's not going to make for like a really dynamic performance necessarily, but it captures the spirit of the film. And that's a very hard thing to do.
And look, we just want to see what she's wearing anyway. But seriously, let's take a step back. And I wonder if you could opine on the purpose of songs in movies. Like, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to kind of capture some ineffable feeling in the screenplay? Mm-hmm. What is it that these songs are meant to do?
Well, this is the thing, Madeline, is there's no rules for what kind of song gets nominated in this category. So we could have songs that are simply designed to play over the end credits and be nominated for Oscars. And we've seen our share of those. We could have songs from musicals, you know, like there was a song that was shortlisted this year from the musical Spirited with Ryan Reynolds and Will Ferrell called Good Afternoon. That would be a very typical nominee. Mm-hmm. And then we see songs that are, you know, sometimes sung by the characters in the films, but are not not musicals, and that can happen as well. So I don't think there's a single answer to your question, which is what can make this category so fun when you have a song from a musical up against an end credits song, up against some other kind of song. It can really go any number of ways. And that's what makes it interesting to me.
Okay, well, let's get to Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. And the song nominated from that movie called This Is a Life. It's performed by Sun Lux, Mitski, and David Byrne.
Not only what we saw.
Okay, so far, this is my favorite of the songs that we've played. What do you think?
I really like it. And a lot like the Rihanna song, it totally captures the spirit of Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. In the lyrics, talking about the various lives that could have been led. I mean, the film is a multiverse movie, and it's completely about that. And I think the form of the song reflects that as well, in that you have these dual vocals, these sort of competing vocals that overlap a bit. And that reflects the overlapping narratives of the movie. And it's just pretty. It's a beautiful sort of ambient song with two singers who have distinct voices that go together very well. I think it's great. And I think it has a chance to win. If Everything, Everywhere, All at Once sweeps the Oscars, which it certainly seems like there's a chance of that, there's a very good chance that they could win in this category as well.
Okay, so moving on to yet another nomination for Diane Warren. I think she's been nominated 14 times. This is a song called Applause from the movie Tell It Like a Woman.
Recognize who you are. Sometimes I know it's so hard, but you shine. You're a supernova superstar.
Okay, so that's Sophia Carson singing there, and the film itself is not nominated in any other categories. What do you think? Is 14 the charm?
No. In fact, I got to be honest, and I don't think I'm the only critic who feels this way. I had never heard of this movie before it was announced.
Me neither.
On Oscar nomination day. No. And I could tell you what it's about, but I would just be reading the description off of Wikipedia. So your listeners can do that themselves. This movie had no profile whatsoever. And this is not the first time this has happened, that Diane Warren has been nominated for a movie nobody really knows or has seen. I mean, she must just be a great Oscar campaigner, and people are good. People are happy to just check her name when they see it. I don't think this is a particularly good song. It's a film nobody's ever heard of or seen. She's never won before. She's really the Susan Lucci of this category. And the funny thing about it is that they gave her an honorary Oscar in 2022. And a lot of folks thought that was a recognition of, you know, the Academy recognized work that she has done, even though she's never won, and maybe a signal to the Academy membership that they should stop nominating her for these songs that nobody's ever heard in movies they've never heard of. And yet the Warren brand is so strong that she was nominated again for such a song.
Well, this raises the question, can you win if you're in a movie that no one's ever heard of? Like, can it be stand out enough that you say, okay, well, this one can win?
I think it's pretty uncommon. I mean, sometimes it can come from a smaller movie that wouldn't be shocking. But this is not just a movie that hasn't been nominated. It's a movie nobody even knows exists. So I think that would be pretty unlikely. And if you look at the rest of the nominees, you've got songs from two films that are Best Picture nominees. You've got a song from Wakanda Forever, which was a big box office hit, and its predecessor, Black Panther, was a Best Picture nominee. And then you've got one more song from a film that is globally beloved, even though it's not nominated for Best Picture. So I think it's fair to say that the nominees in this category and the winners typically come from films that people do know.
Okay, well, let's hear that song. It is called Natu Natu from the Indian musical RRR, and here's a clip.
What is Natu? Polam gattu dummulo na potla gitta dukinattu polerama jataralo pota raju uginattu kirru seppulesukoni karra samu chesinattu marri sottu neelalona kurra gumpu koodinattu erra jonna rottelona nilapadokku galivinattu na paata soodu naatu 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 veela naatu.
This is actually the first song to be nominated in this category from an Indian production, despite, you know, being worldwide renowned for musicals, Indian films are. And this is a film that got a lot of buzz when it first came out. It was in theaters. It did pretty well here in the US. It did very well all over the world. It's really a big kind of Hollywood style blockbuster. It's 3 hours long. It's filled with action sequences. It's filled with musical numbers. It's a big popcorn movie. It's a lot of fun. And I will tell you, if people have skepticism that they're going to like it, when you get to this number, which is about 45 minutes into the movie, you're going to be in, because it is just an irresistible musical number, a dance, a huge dance sequence at a party or a wedding. And there's so much joy. It's just irresistible. And I strongly recommend people check out the movie if they can. I think it's going to make for a fantastic musical number at the Oscars. I don't know what they have planned, but if it's anything like what is seen in the movie, it's going to be a lot of fun. And I think it's going to win.
You think it's going to win Best Song?
I do. It did win the Golden Globe for Best Original Song, which isn't always a predictor. But I think there's a groundswell of support for this movie. It really is beloved by pretty much everyone who has seen it.
All right. Let's talk about snubs. What is a notable snub this year?
I kind of think the song I mentioned earlier from Spirited, Good Afternoon, it's called, is a notable snub, just because that's a traditional musical. And there weren't many of those this year. In fact, I think Spirited was the only high-profile traditional Hollywood musical to come out this year. So I was pretty surprised that wasn't nominated. And, you know, on a personal note, if I were running this category and picking the nominees, I would have picked a song like Apartment for Sale from Tar, which is not at all like the kind of song they typically nominate in this category. It's a song that the character sings when she's sort of having a breakdown towards the end of the film. She's trying to prevent her neighbors from selling an apartment in her building. So she pulls out an accordion and starts singing this really kind of funny, horrible song. it's not a pleasing song to the ear in any way, but it is a brilliant demonstration of her character, where she's at that moment in the film. It's really funny. And I would really love to see the Academy kind of look at the category a little differently, and not just nominate the best pop songs, but nominate any song that is written for a film that adds to the film in a meaningful way. So that one would be my choice.
Well, next year, when you are a voting member of the Academy,
from your lips,
things will be different.
I hope so.
Noah, it's been really fun. Thanks for coming back on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Noah Gittel, film critic. His work is featured in The Atlantic, GQ, among others. He also lectures on the Oscars for the Smithsonian's educational program called Smithsonian Associates. And that will do it for us today on a rainy Monday on Press Play. Don't forget, you can check us out on Twitter or Instagram. We are at KCRW Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever you want. And you can subscribe wherever you get your other podcasts. It's free, of course. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.